Welcome to Merely Catholic with me, Gavin Ashenden. The first time I saw Dr. Reinhard Klein was at the inquest into the death of Ray Parker, a man whose family claimed he died prematurely because of medical negligence. As soon as he entered the courtroom, I knew he was a big guy. I don't mean he was tall, he wasn't. He was probably less than 6 feet. But I recognized instantly that here was a big man in a metaphysical sense. He strolled in and owned the room. What makes some people like that? Magnetism? Charisma? Confidence? Klein had these qualities by the bucket load. He was good-looking, too, and he knew it. His lush brown hair was slicked tidily back. His navy suit was immaculately tailored, following the contours of his gym-toned physique as perfectly as a coat of paint. You know, if I could have touched Dr. Klein on any part of his body, I think I'd have felt silk. 100% mulberry, grade A, 22-mom silk. Well, with these words, narrated by the character of freelance journalist Jenny Bradshaw, S.P. Caldwell opens his debut novel, The Beast of Bethulia Park, which, in the view of William Cash, who's read it, is a gripping psychological novel with Catholic themes, but also a wonderful thriller in its own right. Cash, a professional author, reader and reviewer himself, actually goes much further in his praise for this work, declaring on the jacket of the book that in Caldwell, a major new talent has arrived. The author, according to Cash, is an exciting new voice with a journalist's eye for crime detail and medical research. He adds that the priest character whom Caldwell has created belongs in the top literary gallery of priest protagonists, who are all too human and find themselves up against clerical authority. William Cash and S.P., or Simon Caldwell, are of course known to each other, as one is the editor of the Catholic Herald, and the other, like myself, is an associate editor of the same title. Caldwell trained as a journalist in the early 1990s, and he's written almost continuously for the Catholic Herald since 1999. As a freelance, he's also written for many other titles, and has spent more than a decade on the foreign desk of the Daily Mail. So what's the story about? You'll find a hint in the blurb. When Ray Parker dies unexpectedly in Bethulia Park Hospital, his suspicious family launch a campaign for justice, it says. They recruit the young and idealistic hospital chaplain, Father Calvin Baines, to find a beautiful nurse who might unmask the doctor they believe is guilty of murder. When Esmerald Essien enters his life, the priest finds his high principles are put to the test in a way which drives him to the edge of despair, as he's propelled into a dark world of sexual obsession, danger, and death. Well, Simon joins me today, and he might be willing to tell us a little more. We're also going to hear a couple of readings from the book itself. And Simon joins me now. Simon, you're about to become a very famous author. Welcome. How great to have you on the show in the conversation.
It's lovely to be here, Gavin. Very famous author. I'm not quite sure. We'll have to wait and see about that.
I think you could very well end up as a cross between G.K. Chesterton and J.K. Rowling. So this...
I never thought of myself that way, but I'm just happy that I'm able to finish this book. And now I'm in a position where it's actually published on September the 30th, which for Catholics like us is significant because it's the patron of it's this feast day, of Saint Jerome, the patron of librarians. In about a week or two, the book will be out, available from the publisher, from all bookshops, and from all digital platforms. And that in itself is for me a wonderful achievement because I never thought it would happen, and I'm so glad it now is happening. Whether I end up like J.K. Rowling is very unlikely.
Well, it was very unlikely that she was going to end up as J.K. Rowling. But we need the title of the book. It's called The Beast of Bethulia Park, and it's by Simon Caldwell, which is you. But that's just for the record, in case anyone is saying, my goodness, I like the sound of this author. I must go and order it from Amazon straight away. Simon, I mean, I've only published one book of my own for my academic research. It was like having a baby. One gives birth to this thing, then it grows legs and goes walkabout, and other people have a relationship with it. What's the process of creation been like for you? Anything like that or something different?
Yes. I mean, I started to write in September 2020, which was, you know, that terrible year of lockdown. And like everybody else, I was feeling very low, especially after a few months of it. You start to feel like your sanity is being tested a little bit. And I was, I've never been one to binge watch on Netflix or watch anything. The only time I watch TV really, apart from on my own, apart from sport, is with my wife. And I tend to watch the programs she wants to watch. I'm just not really that bothered about television. I'd much rather curl up with a book. And usually I read stuff like autobiographies and history, that kind of thing. But in that particular year, I turned back to fiction and I was reading lots and lots of fiction. And I was reading my old favorites as well as the new stuff. And an idea formed in my mind that I had a story, you know, that I could tell. And I thought, well, maybe perhaps I should have a go. And when I sat down to write the book, my main ambition really was just to finish it. But then, like you say, it seems to take a life of its own. And I realized that in some of the passages, there's this pace and a voice and the characters were coming alive. And I thought, well, maybe I really should try and get this published. So we spent through countless revisions. The first version was very flawed, I think. There's lots and lots of rookie errors. But the people I gave it to came back to me and said, I couldn't put it down. I was sat till 2 o'clock in the morning, my eyes smarting. I wanted to finish it. I wanted to know what happened. But then they were also telling me it's flawed, you know, and I still had more work to do on it. So it took me a bit of time to get it exactly right. And then when it was at an advanced stage, like you said, people make it their own and they relate to it in their own kind of way. I did have that experience from the people who were reading it. They entered the lives of the characters and the characters meant something to them. So it's very encouraging for a debut novelist like me to see something like that happen.
Well, is it a joke that you've called your Catholic priest hero Calvin?
No.
Did you do that on purpose? Where did you get... So two questions. Is this a tease? And secondly, what's the book about?
Okay. He's called Calvin because he's a convert. He's from an evangelical background. He's from London. He supports Queen's Park Rangers. And he's talked about his father being more like Glasgow Rangers and Queen's Park Rangers and how they struggled to accept his decision, first of all, to convert to the Catholic faith and then become a Catholic priest. So that's why he's called Calvin. Calvin was the first character which I got right. And it came very easily. I mean, the previous year, I'd been to the canonization of John Henry Newman. And I had in my mind that this character of a young priest, a convert, who was very attractive, very modern, somebody who wanted to engage with the world, but wasn't being shaped with the world by the world. Someone who was radically orthodox, shamelessly countercultural, but very, very likable. So Calvin, he's this young priest who's what William Moddy would have once referred to as belonging to the Ratzinger generation. He's not intimate with the papacy of Francis, for example. He's been formed by documents like Veritatis Splendor, Evangelium Vitae, and all the great teachings of Benedict. So he's a zealous young priest who's trusted by his superiors. He's appointed to his own parish at a remarkably young age, and they've got great hopes for him. They're going to make him the diocesan archivist. But his point of weakness is that he gets lonely. But when he's like St. Peter, he doubts his faith, he sinks beneath the waves. So that point, of course, he meets this beautiful nurse called Emerald Essien. She's very, very different from him. Calvin's a virgin, Emerald isn't. She's a woman of the world. She's highly sexual. She's beautiful. She's troubled. And the lives become inextricably interwoven as together they pursue a murderous doctor, the eponymous beast of Bethulia Park. And then Calvin gets himself into all kinds of trouble.
It's beginning to excite my interest all over again, though I've read an early draft. So do you have a reading you could give us to flesh out something of Calvin's character to allow us to start our own relationship with him?
Yes, certainly. Okay, this is from chapter 10, which is called The Fifth Beetle. And I'm going to take it up where Calvin goes into a pub in Liverpool, which he remembers from his student days. It was a pub Calvin remembered from his student days. A decade later, he'd found it hadn't changed a bit. Shabby chic furniture, polished oak parquet floorboards, a high ceiling creating a cavernous space, and huge windows allowing buckets of light to flood in. He had often imagined the pub in its Victorian heyday and how beautiful it would have been, filled with smoke, twisting in golden and silver plumes like incense rising to heaven in some Roman basilica. He leaned on the bar, waiting to order a lime and soda, and began to reflect how he had changed personally all the while this lovely old building stood still. Being there reminded him of some of his earliest and clumsiest parts of an interior journey on which he was still travelling. Back then, he had one foot in the New Jerusalem and the other dragging in the gutter. His religious awakening was progressing rapidly during his time at university, making him the butt of the jokes of the fellow students, who for a while continued to be his friends. They could not understand why a young man who was tall, blonde, and built like an athlete did not share their enthusiasm for hedonistic pursuits, especially since he could have surely exploited his natural gifts to glorious effect. They marvelled that he was so evidently shy in the company of women and were perplexed that he never seemed to want a girlfriend. When he admitted his virginity, some almost wept with laughter. They gave him the nickname Nonny and taunted him relentlessly. A lot of the time, they pretended he was either gay or obsessed with pleasuring himself. He took their ribbing in good humour. It would usually start in a place like this pub, with the first or second pint of the night, as they were settling down. Typically, one of his companions would address him with a statement like, "It'll fall off, you know." "What will fall off?" he would ask. The assembled company would roll about, collapsing into a contagion of ribaldry and bawdy jokes, as they deployed the most comical euphemisms of the day to accuse him of an addiction to onanism. "No, really, you ought to get yourself a girlfriend," he'd hear, as he blushed uncontrollably, and their laughs descended into tearful, red-faced titters. At that time, he tried to join the fun. He took their jibes on the chin and compromised as much as he could, though daring not to admit to the raucous party that he never masturbated. That would be worse. It would have surely opened up a whole new seam of comic put-downs that would run for months. They would never have understood him if he had tried to explain to them that he had accomplished self-mastery over his passions by his early teens and that he believed he reigned as king over his body. It would have marked him out as a complete weirdo. Better to be called Nonny than the other names they might dream up for him if they came out with a line like that. It would be different now, of course. He would perceive any suggestion that he was anything less than chaste as an insult and would openly confess what he really thought of autoerotic behaviour, that it was a sin, an aberration. The one constant would be their wholly negative attitude to him and to what he stood for.
This is rather exciting. Now, that's your own style. What's fed into your style to give it some kind of foundation upon which you've built your own balustrades? Who do you read to begin to write like that?
Well, I'm very much a child of the 20th century, late 20th century. And at the time, I think like many men of my age, they tend to stop reading fiction after about 40. So most of my fiction was read. So like in the sort of late part of the 20th century. So I was reading, I've read adult fiction since I was a kid. My parents were called into school by my primary school head teacher, who was a nun, when I was in what was then the fourth year, to be ticked off about me bringing Ian Fleming books in. I was reading all the James Bond set one after another. Then you can't let him read this. This is adult fiction. But I read it quite easily, quite readily. You know, I did all those things like I read Tolkien and all that kind of stuff as well. But yeah, as growing up, I was reading Jack London, Graham Greene, Conrad, a big favourite of mine. And then I got into the American crime writers as well. And I loved Elmore Leonard, but the one I like more than any is an American crime writer called George V. Higgins. I don't know if you've ever come across him. It was one of my favourite crime book of all time is a book called The Friends of Eddie Coyle. Now, Higgins was a high-ranking prosecutor who saw these characters, these criminals, mobsters at first hand, and he listened to how they talked. And he replicated the dialogue in his books. And it's really gritty realism, and it was dialogue led. I'm not going to pretend that I'm a great writer. I wouldn't claim that at all. But what I did have, I thought was a great story, and I just wanted to tell it. So the story is really, it's plot, dialogue, and action. And I'm a journalist as well, you see. So you're not going to get literary fiction from me. You're going to get doorstep English. So that's how the style kind of emerged. So what I've tried to do is write in a clear style with lots of pace, lots of excitement, and good dialogue. As far as possible.
You're very good at it, but you know, we work together on the Herald, and occasionally, particularly for this podcast, you produce the punchy, dynamic stuff whilst I labour along with sentences that are about five times too long, the wrong kind of language. So I've always loved your writing and think you do a very good job on it. So obviously it's a murder mystery. Is there a point? I've just started reading fiction again. I quite like J.K. Rowling's Strike series, which are all murder mysteries. She has the capacity to bind you in to the narrative and the world of the people. And this does strike me as being quite similar. One develops really quite a kind of almost a prurient interest. What are these people going to get up to now? As an author, is there a point? Or like Mozart, have you heard a melody, you've heard a story, and you just want to tell it?
A little bit. I mean, I've read the Strike series as well. I never read a Harry Potter book, but I started reading Strike in 2020 when I saw somebody on TV saying, don't buy these books. And I thought, well, I'm going to buy them all now. So she's done quite well. J.K. Rowling's done quite well out of me in that respect. And yeah, I think what makes them such a success, of course, is the energy, this sexual tension between Strike and his junior partner. I haven't...
Six novels, and they still haven't got it together.
but anyway, yeah, what we got in my novel is that there's definitely a frisson between Calvin and the nurse. I haven't copied Robert Galbraith at all. What that emerged from is... when I was drawing the character of the priest, and he has this weakness. He's a man with the instincts of a man. And when he's confronted by this beautiful nurse who suddenly enters his life, it turns his world upside down. And then it sends him a bit mad, actually. And I don't think I'm going to ruin the story by saying that he starts to imagine that she's Judith out of the Bible, that she's Judith of Bethulia. And just in case anybody isn't familiar with the story of Judith, well, she was this beautiful widow who saved the Israelites from the Assyrian general Holofernes, who was dehydrating them all to death by disarming him with her beauty. So he gets drunk and he thinks he's on for a good night, but she cuts his head off with his own sword. So it's inspired like centuries and centuries of artwork. Wherever you go, you see Judith. You know, she's always painted probably more than Saint Sebastian, I'd say. So the priest thinks that because he sees similarities with her, he knows she's a widow emerald, and he starts to think that she's Judith, a type of Judith. So he goes, and part of the book, a large part of the book, is what perhaps makes it a psychological thriller is the way the priest wrestles with his own mental state, and also with this temptation to sin. Now, I mean, this is very different from Robert Galbraith, because what happens there is the two characters, they tend to stay apart because they know that their professional relationship will suffer if they became an item. Whereas with Calvin and Emerald, he thinks, you know, on a more supernatural level, that it will destroy his ministry, it will change the person that he will be. It will put him into a state of mortal sin. So all these other factors come into play there.
So is this a kind of morality tale? Are you helping either priests or those who identify with priests or those who deal with them? Are you helping them manage the whole complexity of sexual and romantic temptation and the duality of body and spirit? Are you describing it? Are you prescribing solutions? What are you doing with it?
I'm not really in a position to be preaching to priests about how they should live their lives. But in this book, it probably differs from a lot of contemporary literature, isn't that my characters pray. Not all of them. Those who are struggling, like Calvin, and it's at one point you see Emerald pray as well, they seek strength from a higher being, from outside themselves. They've got these enormous problems, these enormous dangers in their lives, and they get on their knees and pray. And what I wanted to say there is, I do believe that the prayer and grace can help you overcome evil and difficulties. And so I wouldn't say it's a morality tale, but I'd say it's definitely a tale told from a Catholic perspective. I mean, we all believe in something. Even people who say they don't believe in God, they still believe in something. They still have an explanation and a way of seeing the world. And this book is obviously, you know, I'm a Catholic, and this is written from my perspective. So I haven't written a book for Catholics. I've written a book for everyone, which has some Catholic themes.
So your second reading, it takes place in the confessional, and that brings together all of the elements we've just been talking about: intimacy, temptation, boundaries, confusion of role, grace. How about a reading from the confessional encounter?
Yes. Okay. This is from chapter 7, which is called Judith Calls, which is the second time which Emerald meets the priest, Father Calvin Baines. And she enters the confessional not just to make a confession, well, in fact, that's a secondary reason. The real reason is she wants to make him an offer that he can't refuse, but I'm not going to tell you what that offer is. You'll have to buy the book. So anyway, here is the reading. Calvin glanced at his watch as he listened to the door on the other side of the curtain swing shut. It was 3:57 p.m. and confessions ended at 4. The priest leaned back, knowing that he would soon be out. After a minute, he stood and was beginning to collect his books when he heard the door open and footsteps coming softly in. He sat down again, waiting for the person to speak. After what seemed an unnaturally long pause, he coughed gently and took the initiative to lead the penitent in prayer. A woman's voice joined in as he made the sign of the cross. Then silence again. "When was your last confession?" began the priest. "Oh, about 15 years ago," the woman replied. And from the five words, Calvin, a Londoner, knew she too was in her 20s or 30s, neither came from or had spent a substantial period of her life in the southeast of England. "And what have you done since then?" "Phew, where do I begin? I've taken quite a lot of Class A drugs, and I've been drunk more times than I can count. I've had a long affair with a married man, which I regret, as well as a few one-night stands, including a heavy flirtation with a woman, but only once. I've lied, nicked stuff, cheated people out of money, lots of it sometimes, driven dangerously, you name it, all kinds. I could go on all afternoon if I put my mind to it. Yeah, I've missed Mass too. I don't think I've been since I was a kid when my dad used to make us all go. Is that bad?" "It's sin, yes," said the priest. "If you think God has brought you here so that you can start afresh, if you want to make a new start in your life for whatever reason, you could just say that you were sorry for all the sins of your past life. You wouldn't have to name them all if you can't remember them. What's most important is that you want to live a good life, a life of the Spirit, and that you find the grace to persevere in virtue and to avoid sin. That you've returned to Jesus after so long is a grace in itself." "Thank you, Father. That's very reassuring," the woman said assertively. "But if I'm truly honest with you, which I really wish to be, a new start is not exactly the reason I'm here. Though it's true that there are some things that have been really giving me grief and I could do with getting them off my chest. I mean, how guilty am I when I know, for example, that someone has done something to someone else to end their life a little bit sooner? How much of the guilt do I share when they make me do that kind of thing and I go along with it, follow orders out of fear of losing my job?" Calvin felt a cold sweat starting. "Am I complicit in that person's death if I don't do something or anything about the things I know are happening?" she said. "And what if I see it happen again and again and again and still don't do anything about it because I don't know what to do about it? I mean, just how much of the blame do I share in this kind of thing, in bringing about these deaths when they might well have been avoidable?" She paused. "Do you know what I'm talking about, or is this too cryptic for you?" "I think so," Calvin said tentatively. "No, I really, really do think that you do know what I'm talking about," said the woman. "So which is worse, adultery, drug abuse, or keeping quiet when you see others kill? You think being an accessory to murder is the easiest thing to avoid, but not my job, it ain't. Does it make me a coward if I just carry on regardless? Is cowardice a sin? Just how bad am I?" She sounded angry and stopped for a moment, waiting for him to speak. When he didn't, she began again, more slowly and in control. "And what if I find a priest creeping around my place of work at night, trying to bust his way into a restricted area where confidential medical records and files on our patients are kept? Would it be a sin to report him, or to protect him? You tell me, Father." From her side of the curtain, she heard the priest stir uncomfortably. She could taste the tension in the dark and closed space in which the secrets of two strangers were being exposed. The woman guessed that if only she could see him, she would have witnessed almost a comical reversal of their roles, in which he, soaked in sweat, his face a shade of bright pink, his eyes glazed and a vein bouncing in his forehead, took the aspect of the repentant sinner, begging forgiveness, and she, the wise counsellor. As if he had read her mind, the priest spoke up. "May I see you, please? I mean, this is something you want to talk about, really, isn't it? Rather than a confession." "I'd like to be able to see you too," she answered. Slowly, the priest pulled the curtain to one side, and through the wire grille, Calvin came face to face with Emerald for the second time.
Wonderful. I want to ask you a question about the place you occupy on the scale of moral judgment, I suppose. One of the reasons I've always loved Graham Greene is because I feel Graham Greene gives absolution for the human condition as I know it, messy, difficult, always falling flat on our face, however aspiring we are to moral virtue. On the other hand, and there's Bunyan, the Protestant moralist, letting us know what the rules are and what the consequences are in an inexorable moral universe. Whereabouts on the scale between Bunyan and Greene does Caldwell sit?
I can't speak with any authority on Bunyan. I've always enjoyed Graham Greene, you know, the morality of human actions. I'd probably say I was more orthodox than Graham Greene. I think Graham Greene was of a generation where, you know, going into the 50s and 1960s, where it was quite, it was becoming fashionable to challenge everything and to take a very liberal approach to various questions. I think now that we've seen what's happened with various revolutions that we've experienced, I'm a bit more like Calvin. I hold to the truths of the Catholic faith and find them to be liberating. So I don't avoid the problem of evil. And certainly there is plenty of sex and violence in this book. And what I don't do is put a cease at the bedside so that people can see what's happening. Or you don't see people getting chopped up or shot or blood and things like that. It's implicit rather than explicit. Graphic light, yeah. I think you just need to have a good story and try and tell it well. I don't use four-letter words either. I just say, if somebody wants to tell someone to F off or C words, and they just say that they swore violently. The readers can imagine it for themselves. Saying that, it doesn't fudge the realistic nature of what's going on. What I've tried to do is draw real characters committing real crimes and doing horrible things that they might do, but in a way which doesn't make the reader feel like they've been slapped across the face.
A few practical questions then. First of all, how much does it cost?
The book, £20.
Yes. I didn't mean the moral cost of being an author. Yeah. Well, you know, obviously, that costs you everything. So £20.
Yeah, I'm sorry for that.
What happens next? Its date of publication is very shortly.
It's going to be published, hopefully, within the next 10 days. Hard copies have come available. It's at the printers at the moment.
And just say it was a success. And they say that everyone has at least one novel in them. That's absolutely not true. I could never begin to write a novel. I'm very impressed by anyone who can do it. Is there a second novel to this? Is there a sequel? Is there a part two? What's in your mind?
Yeah, I've begun a sequel, but I think a lot of it will depend on the success of this one. I think the characters in this book could certainly have the potential to enter a new situation in which they confront evil characters and sort them out. So,
Simon, I've had a privilege of reading a draft. I'm looking forward very much to getting it between hard copies, and I expect it's going to be a tremendous success. And I look forward very much to the next conversation when we discuss the publication of part two, the sequel. Simon Caldwell, author extraordinaire, Catholic apologist, member of the staff of the Catholic Herald. Thank you very much indeed. It's been great. Can't wait to read it.
Thank you very much, Carl.